Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi guys, welcome back to another episode of Textory. I hope you have your tea brewed and ready. If you don't know what's going on, Textory is a podcast where we are reading historical texts one episode at a time and discussing them and reacting to them. Also, if you want to support me and support what I'm doing, please head to patreon.com/textory and let's jump into it. Today we are time traveling to the end of the 18th century. 1790s, to be exact. We've already heard the perspective of a Georgian-era courtesan, so a very high-level sex worker. Today, we are going the opposite direction. We're going to the lowest of the low. So, starting off, the end of the 18th century, what was their approach to female sexuality? Things were not great after the French Revolution because obviously everything that went on before the French Revolution was associated with fallen morality. So royalty and Marie Antoinette basically symbolized moral decay, whereas what's new, what's coming, all of the revolutionary ideas was supposed to be much better than what they just got rid of. So revolution-connected writers argued that it was immoral women that led to like this moral decay of the nation. So they were trying to reframe women of the French nation as sort of mothers of the nation, like motherhood was their prime purpose. And it is true that earlier in the 18th century, before that happened, people were a lot more open to descriptions of sexuality. So there were a lot of libertine novels where there was this sort of celebration of love and this light approach to relationships between men and women. And it was in this all like very elegant Rococo style. If you've ever read any of the novels that they read back then, it's very, very light. It's like, we're having fun. Unless it's like Dangerous Liaisons, but then that's later in the century. And by the end of the century, all of the texts, all of the approach is turning a little more moralistic in tone. Like everyone's trying to prove that they are morally on a higher ground. So that was France, but that was the general vibe at the time, was by the end of the century, everyone was trying to do better than their predecessors. So basically, whatever went down in the Rococo era, everyone was like, we're not going to repeat that. It was also a different generation of people. So people that were young in 1780s, 1790s, they saw their parents' lifestyles and they were like, okay, that's enough. We're just going to go the complete opposite direction. We're going to say cool, basically. I'm not saying that before that, women that were basically fallen women, so to speak, had it any better than that. But I'm just trying to set the tone of what the era was like. Because today we're talking about women who lost their virtue, basically, and what they could do about it. We are reading Advice to Unmarried Women to Recover and Reclaim the Fallen and to Prevent the Fall of Others into the Snares and Consequences of Seduction. This one's from 1791. I do believe this text was written by a church person because he didn't sign it. It's an anonymous text. But judging by the fact that he's referring to his like churchgoers, he was probably a minister. And the text is basically a brochure for unmarried women who have illegitimate children to convince them to come back to church, to come back to the right path. He has a lot of arguments. Some of them are actually really surprising. So let's check that out. The writer of this address, having had frequent occasions in the course of his duty in a large parish, to give his advice to young women in the situation of those for whom it is designed. He is induced by the belief that his endeavors have in some cases been attended with success, and the hope that others in the same situation might be benefited, to extend his advice beyond the limits of his parochial care, to the unfortunate objects of that description in general. So he basically has given this advice to his local parish women, and he was just like, I'm actually too good. I don't want to waste this talent on nothing, so let me write a brochure. The first step to amendment and to reconciliation with God and with the world is to be sensible of your sins. This I trust many of you are, and that your own feelings of shame and remorse would spare me the pain of recalling to your minds the situation in which you stand both with the world and with God. But not all in your unhappy situation are sensible of their guilt or the consequences of it. Though brought to this state of infamy and ruin, abandoned by the man they loved, and left to encounter alone the shame and difficulties into which he has brought them, cast out and forsaken by their friends, shunned by their companions, loaded with ignominious reproaches among their equals, and without a character to regain admission into the families of their superiors. There are among you some who are not yet sensible how sinful and wretched their condition is. Okay, let's unpack this for a moment, because that's a lot. He's basically describing all the ways in which a woman was completely lost and suffering by choosing to be unmarried and choosing to have a relationship with a man prior to marriage. So basically, not only was she completely alone after he left, but also she completely lost. She lost everything. I'm still, honestly, when I read some of those like memoirs or letters, I'm honestly shocked that knowing what the stakes are, women even did this. Like, women even had sex, because honestly, this could make or break you. You lost your family, you lost your friends, you lost your house, you lost your life, you lost everything that you had. For a man? You did this for what? No, but no one faced that many consequences for that action. The man was never received any sort of treatment similar to what women had to go through. And not even when they fell pregnant, even if nothing happened, still. A man would absolutely be welcome back home. A man would absolutely be welcome back to his society after ruining an innocent woman's life. That is so absolutely absurd to me. You could be seduced, you could be assaulted, and the blame would still go to you, and the men would enjoy everything in life. And I'm not saying it's something that's still not happening nowadays, because we know that like under 1% of sexual assault cases end in actually the perpetrator getting punished. So it's still going. But at least the reaction of society, even if not the law enforcement or the police, is a little different. Or the reaction to society knowing that a man has hurt you, not necessarily done something against your will, but just mistreated you, is a little different. Like, at least you have your friends to depend on. But back then, you're left with nothing. And this was actually dangerous. Like, you could end up actually dying because you would be in the streets with your newborn baby, or you would die in labor because there was no one to ask for help. And he does speak about it after. Young and inexperienced, you admitted to your acquaintance men whose designs you had not the judgment to discover nor discretion to escape. Tired of service and eager to be independent, as you thought, in your haste to become the wife, you became the prostitute of the man you loved. His character, his connections, his ability to maintain you if you should become his wife, you never considered. His regard for you, you believed to be the same as yours for him, and his dispositions you measured by your own. You gave him credit for the most pure and honorable intentions, and you were perhaps not to be persuaded to the contrary, though your parents or friends might intimate their suspicions and fears. This is actually true, again, thinking back to Harriet Wilson's memoirs that we've discussed in a different episode, she did mention that it was a matter of just wanting to leave her home. It was a matter of just wanting to be independent and not having to depend on people that didn't care about you, that did you wrong. In a lot of the cases, you know, obviously the parents were like, no, you can't marry a man, you're only 15. And then the man was like, yeah, they don't understand what we have. What we have is special. You're so mature for your age. And he would just take her away. So again, why was the woman blamed for this? Like, why would a 15, 16-year-old be supposed to know any better? The senses of modesty once broken down, the repetition of your shame became easy to your seducer. The repetition of promises of marriage on his part, the consciousness of having nothing on yours to refuse, together with the fear lest he should leave you if you should now offend him, made you a slave to his lusts. Till at length you found what your prudence should have told you before, that the man who robs you of your virtue means not to make you his wife, that if he had meant to marry you, he would have been the first to protect your virtue and not to seduce it. This is actually a good point. If a man was willing to risk his beloved's everything, if he was like, what I want is actually more important than the entirety of your life, then I don't think it's a husband material, girl. I don't know what to tell you. I think it sounds selfish. And obviously, it probably wasn't the case every time. Like, some of those situations were probably just two people being horny. I don't know. But just the fact that someone was willing to put his beloved's life on a stake like this, it's giving I don't care about you. By whatever steps you lost your virtue, whatever were the motives on your part, or the arts on the part of your seducer, what, let me ask, were your feelings when you found yourself deceived, abandoned, and undone? Alas, fruitless tears, unavailing complaint, solitary hours of remorse, and dread of that shame which a few months more would bring to light, succeeded to the happy hours which you passed in the service or situation which you left. At this point, I was like, why is he talking about like few months? And then I realized that this is supposed to be directed at pregnant women or women that gave birth to illegitimate children, because then he goes on to say, at length the hour arrived, the painful hour, which is naturally attended with dread and pain and peril enough, but in your case was accompanied with feelings far more distressing than the temporary sufferings of your delivery. The fear lest that which is the only comfort to sustain the suffering mother in other cases, the child that is to be born, should live. Live to be your reproach and shame. So he's saying that labor itself being already traumatizing enough and painful enough, women in this situation also have to go through wishing that their children were not okay, which is insane. But basically what he's saying is, it carried so much shame, and obviously a lot of them did not want to be mothers, that by the time that their delivery came, some were hoping that the children would just die. To the dread and sufferings of childbirth were added the reproaches of guilt and the shame of its discovery. No joy to you that a child is born into the world. No happy father to welcome its birth. No congratulating friends to rejoice with you when it is over. Not even any to comfort and assist you in your sufferings. Perhaps not the necessary assistance that your situation needed. Much less the comforts which the virtuous woman, however low in life, finds some tender neighbor ever ready to administer in this time of need. This is really sad when you think about it. I never really thought about it that way. The loneliness of unmarried mothers. No one would be around to help you. People would low-key hope you would die in labor, because then you wouldn't be an issue to anyone and no one would have to deal with what they saw as shameful behavior. So not only do you not get the support of your surroundings, you don't get any surroundings. You don't get a friendly neighbor to come over and help you, because then the neighbor's going to be associated with what you've done. And everyone's going to be like, well, if her morals are so loose, then that probably means if the neighbor's okay with that, they're also that loose. So we're not going to associate with the neighbor. So it was basically this domino of rejection that couldn't be stopped. And you just could not rely on anyone but other women in this situation, I guess. In the first place, let me advise you, as you value your reputation, your interest, your happiness in this life and that which is to come, shun your betrayer. Have no communication whatever with him. See him not, hear not from him, read not any of his professions. He's basically saying, be no contact with your baby daddy. Do not read his text. Do not answer his calls. If he comes over, do not open the door because he doesn't mean it. He's not actually going to help you. I'm going to have to say this is one of the most surprising bits of this text because we all know the lengths that people in the era went to ensure that whoever was in that situation got married eventually. We all know what Mr. Bennet and Mr. Darcy did in Pride and Prejudice when Lydia ran away with Mr. Wickham. Everyone was like, they need to get married. We don't care that he's a bad guy. We don't care that he is not husband material. They need to get married because that's less evil than having to deal with an unmarried daughter that's in this situation. So it's actually surprising to me that he's like, actually, don't marry him. At this point, don't marry him. And he's also like, don't believe him because he doesn't mean to marry you. He's gonna just do that same thing again. Trust no man, says this minister. He means only again to seduce and to abandon you. Suffer none of his plausible tales of remorse and promises of marriage to reach you. He will, if he can, contrive to fall in your way, or he will endeavor through some friend to convey into your hands the false vows which may induce you to admit him again into your company. And you will be but too much inclined yourself to listen to his falsehood and believe that he is yet disposed to marry you. But if you wish to avoid the repetition of your guilt and disgrace, shun him as the enemy to your peace. Banish him not only from your affections, but from your very thoughts. If you admit him into your company, you are undone. I am laughing because it sounds 100% like one of those videos that are like, do not get back with your ex. If he tries to reach you, that's on him. Do not answer. If you give him a moment's credit for a disposition to make you satisfaction for the injury he has done you, your ruin is nearly effected. He will again persuade you to believe that he means to marry you, and your own credulity will easily give him credit for all the sorrow and sincerity he professes. But his professions are now not only to be suspected, they are certainly false. You may be assured they are. The man who could seduce your virtue, who could bring you into your present situation and leave you exposed to all the shame and difficulties that you have had to suffer, is a base deceiver, by whom you must be weak indeed if you are again to be betrayed. He's basically like, have some dignity, girl. He doesn't deserve you. To your resolution in this respect, let me add the prudence that will be necessary with respect to other men. This is actually a very interesting point that I didn't think about. Again, like, this guy is making me think about a lot of things I didn't take into account. One of them being, if everyone around you knew that you've already done it once, they would try to take advantage of you. And I didn't think about that. I just thought that everyone's going to be like, I want to have nothing to do with you. But actually, that does open the door to bad men to try and get some, basically. So he's saying, if you are in a family where there are other servants, the men will think themselves at liberty. Perhaps your female fellow servants will encourage them to try the virtue which has once been overcome, and they will expect to find no great difficulty to effect their design. Till you have convinced them by a prudence and propriety of conduct, and by a spirited resistance of their wicked designs, that you are not the woman they take you to be, you must expect that they will take greater liberties with you than with any other woman. So basically, whoever knew your story would treat you in a different way than they would a regular, let's say, woman, because they would think that they can get away with it. You will therefore find it necessary to keep them at a greater distance. The modest reserve that becomes your sex, and particularly your situation, must forbid the approaches of rudeness and the liberties they would take. By thus placing a double guard where you find yourself exposed to danger, you will at length discourage, if you do not shame them, from repeating their attempts. The firmness and the modesty of your behavior will be a check to their rudeness, and force them to desist from their purpose with shame to themselves and credit to you. I don't think it was as simple as basically rejecting them all the time. I think it must have been a much more complicated situation for women in that case. And then he speculates like what women should take away from the situation, how they should reflect on what happened to them. And he's saying basically that they should analyze why it came to this and what happened. From your own experience, learn where your greatest danger lies. Was it a too great confidence in the man you loved that led to your ruin? Trust not the most plausible professions and appearances in future. Above all others, trust not the man who has already robbed you of your character and peace. Was it by imperceptible degrees of familiarity that he made the advances which he did? And did you, as you drew nearer to the lawful consummation of your wishes, become less guarded in the liberties you allowed him? Till at length your prudence and discretion left you. Passion was left exposed to passion, to artifice and temptation, and you insensibly yielded to his lust. So I'm assuming he's referring to people that were like already engaged. And as they went on closer to getting married, they just didn't wait. I think that's what he's saying. But also the idea that a woman can only sleep with someone because she yielded to their lust and she doesn't have any sort of sexual needs herself is definitely very 18th century. Was it by the aid of intoxicating liquors that he accomplished his design? I do not suppose you to be a drunkard. Drunkenness is bad enough in men, but a drunken woman is a disgrace to her sex. He goes on a whole rant about how women shouldn't drink, basically, but it was given as one of the reasons why someone would end up in this situation, so I'm assuming it must have happened a lot. Was it vanity, the childish vanity of dress, that so beguiled you? Did you yield to the solicitation of someone superior to yourself to gratify the pride of being better dressed, supplied with money, and living at your ease? So he's basically saying that some women just did it for pretty dresses, which I think is a gross simplification of what happened. But I'm assuming there were some women that just wanted to have sugar daddies. And that's, you know, in 18th century, that made complete sense, because especially when it comes to clothing and your appearance, whatever you wore would allow you to be in different social circles or would make people treat you differently. So it was actually much more influential than he makes it sound. And then he is concluding the whole case with saying, I have done. I cannot say more to induce you to turn from the error of your way and life. If you are disposed to be reconciled with God, to be received again into the favor of your friends, and to be restored to the situation from which you have fallen, if you have any desire to recover your peace of mind, your happiness in the present life, and to obtain eternal happiness in the next, you will listen to the advice I give you, and afford me the satisfaction to hope that it has not been given in vain. God grant that you may well consider these things, and that you may have the wisdom and grace to see in this your day the things which belong to your peace. Okay, that's his conclusion. I omitted some of his advice because it was mostly like spiritual, so I didn't think it would be too interesting to read. But what I'm thinking is how he juxtapositioned the idea of being a fallen woman in the Georgian society with reclaiming your virtue, fixing your relationship with God and being welcomed back into society. The truth is, it wasn't that black and white, because A, neither were you a part of the regular society when you came back to church and when you like confessed to your sins, when you were like trying to live as an honest woman. You would still be ostracized 100%. You probably will not have any friends. You may speak to your neighbors if they want to speak to you. But the truth is, 90% of the cases, it was just hopeless. You would not get anything out of it, apart from like clear conscience, maybe. On the other hand, he has this idea that women who had this happen to them were those like sad victims that someone took advantage of. A, we cannot be sure that that was the case. Someone probably went into it knowing full well what the consequences were and just agreeing with the consequences. But also, I mean, by the standards of the era, women definitely got the shorter end of the stick at the end of the day because they did lose a lot. However, not all fallen women and not all sex workers were lonely and sad. So this stereotype of women that ended up being prostitutes because they were seduced and then they got pregnant is not entirely true. First of all, most female prostitutes were actually married and their husbands were also criminals, so they were like conducting businesses together. At least in 18th century England, that was apparently the case. So for example, prostitutes did not always rely on sex work, but they would sometimes use that to their advantage to basically steal from people. So they would look for vulnerable individuals, like drunk people, and they would basically steal from them. Or a lot of brothels, a lot of nets of prostitutes were being organized by women. So they weren't always those like powerless beings depending on male help. They could also do some jobs, some businesses. And while it definitely was not easy to conduct it and be respected by people knowing that they know, it was definitely possible. And apparently the world where the whole business of prostitution was controlled by men, it was only the case in the later decades, in mid-19th century. But in the 18th century, women that were like at the bottom of society were actually quite independent. But it still remains true that if you ended up in this situation and if you did not intend to become a sex worker or if you were still trying to be a part of respectable society, you would probably be screwed. It was probably not gonna happen. What I find interesting is that none of his advice is try and get married at any cost. Like, he never brings that up. He never mentions that. And he's never like, it would be good if you had a husband who would pretend that this child is yours. Which is interesting because a lot of the media, like I'm thinking Bridgerton season one, they made us think that as soon as someone got pregnant, they would be like, oh my God, we need to find her a husband ASAP. We need to sell her off because then it's going to make it sound proper. He is even advising them against marrying their baby daddies. He's even like, no, don't do that. Don't go there. He's not a good man. Which I find very interesting because at the end of the day, this is a minister that we're talking about. This is a man of God. So you would think that his primary concern would be to get that woman married, like marry her off to whoever comes first. But no, he's like, it's better for you if you just live your life in a godly way. And that's your biggest concern right now, and be a good mother to your baby. And do not blame the baby for the mistakes that you have made, which I think is like solid advice in that era, because why traumatize another generation? I do find it very surprising how critical he is in general of the man that did that to them. And I know that it's also because this brochure was directed at the women who would probably be happy with someone taking their side. But I think you can tell that this is coming from his heart. Like, he actually means it. He actually hates those men. And he's like, I have seen this happen so many times, and every time it's the guy. I just think he is an interesting character for sure. Who he is, I actually don't know. But I actually like this guy. I think he had made a lot of good points while at the same time obviously being very critical of the women. But I mean, he was also a minister. Like, what do we expect? So considering all that, I think he's done a pretty good job. I mean, if I was a woman at the time that wanted to come back to church and I have read this brochure, I would probably be like, hell yeah, at least he wants me there. At least he's not like condemning me. At least he cares about my well-being. At least he cares about my baby. So I think that's pretty unusual for 1791 to make someone feel that way while you know that you're talking to what everyone else considers a sinner. Either way, thank you guys for listening. A shout out to all the unmarried women with children out there. Hope y'all are doing well, and I'll hear you in another episode. Why did I say another like this? That's kind of weird. Another episode. And don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textree. Bye!